NBC News Radio, I'm Scott Walterman. Denver getting 2 inches of snowfall an hour this morning. So far, at least 170 flights canceled and traveled by car getting dangerous, too. Here's reporter Megan Fitzgerald with NBC affiliate KUSA on I-70.
At this point, we're told there's about 300 plows that are going to be on these roads, but they are slick. The biggest concern is visibility. As the wind starts to pick up, they will not hesitate to shut down the interstate.
They are not shutting down the Daytona Speedway. The Daytona 500 will go green flag racing today following a crash yesterday that injured at least 33 fans.
First and foremost, our thoughts and prayers are with our race fans. We're in the process of repairing this facility and we'll be ready to go racing.
Daytona President Joey Chitwood. The race making history today as Danica Patrick becomes the first woman ever to win the pole at the Great American Race. This is NBC News Radio. Pope Benedict has delivered his final blessing to more than 100,000 people in St. Peter's Square.
Thank you.
NBC's Duncan Golestani reports from Rome.
Pope Benedict appeared at his apartment window and told the cheering crowds he is not abandoning the Catholic Church. The 85-year-old is the first pope to resign from the papacy in 600 years. His announcement earlier this month shocked the world. Pope Benedict has one more public appearance before he retires, his weekly audience on Wednesday. Duncan Golestani, NBC News.
Tonight the Oscars, but last night it was the Razzies. The Twilight Saga Breaking Dawn Part 2 savaged at the annual awards ceremony. The entire Twilight Saga cast earned a Razzie for Worst Screen Ensemble. I'm Scott Walterman, NBC News Radio.
And now Geico presents 30 Seconds with Maxwell the Pig.
Maxwell, you're on.
Cool. And so you just want me to read the script? You don't want me to do the wee thing? Okay, today I'm going to talk about the new Geico mobile app and how you can manage your policy and get your ID card and customize it with your favorite Geico character. But I'm not yelling we or anything, because they don't want me to, right?
Correct.
Okay, just saying it's my thing.
Everything you love about Geico, now mobile. Download the new Geico app today.
Quietus contains homeopathic ingredients traditionally used to provide relief.
Can you hear that sound? That ringing? That hissing?
I can't get to sleep with it.
I can't concentrate. I hear it constantly.
It's tinnitus.
A constant ringing in your ear.
Ah, finally. Quietus.
I couldn't believe it. No more ringing in the ears. No more hissing sound.
Call right now for your risk-free trial of Quietus at 1-800-713-3982. 1-800-713-3982. 1-800-713-3982.
Hey everybody, it's David and Nikki Nellis with Foodie and the Beast, the D.C. area's one and only and best food and wine variety show.
On Sunday, February 24th, we'll be talking with new chef Andrew Merkert. He is opening up his restaurant, Buchart. He's working with lots of area farmers, and he's bringing some in. And the Capital Wine Festival is back. I believe we'll be tasting some wine.
I believe we will. That's Foodie and the Beast next Sunday and every Sunday at 11, right here on 1500 AM.
I'm on a mission to spread the word about COPD through music. COPD stands for chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. My grandfather suffered from symptoms of it, and COPD is the fourth leading cause of death in the U.S. I'm Billy Ray Cyrus, and I drive for COPD. Looks like people are starting to get the message. Anyone age 35 and older who has smoked as little as 100 cigarettes could be at risk. Visit driveforcopd.com today and talk to your doctor.
Hi, this is O'Donna Matthews. What does three decades of service add up to? For the Capital Area Food Bank, it includes these important numbers. Distributing 25 million pounds of food to nearly 500,000 people through a network of 700 partner agencies. 30 years, it's a long time. But the mission continues to make sure that no one is left hungry. To learn more, contribute, or volunteer, visit capitalareafoodbank.org.
When every moment matters and a hand reaches out, when someone gives blood and a life is saved, that moment when heartbreak turns to hope, you're there through the American Red Cross. Every day, the Red Cross responds to nearly 200 neighborhood emergencies, and your support makes it possible. Use this moment to join us today. Visit redcross.org.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Executive Leaders Radio. In this hour, you'll hear directly from our region's finest business leaders. Through each of the interviews, these high-achieving leaders become relatable role models who share how they were able to build their enterprise, their personal secrets of success, about leadership styles and opportunities that lie ahead. Prepare to be inspired and entertained and to hear wisdom unheard elsewhere. Executive Leaders Radio.
You're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Peter Schwartz. I'm joined by my co-host, Dana Theos, with Empower Consulting. And we have a great lineup of guests on our show today, including Willie Walker, who's the chairman, CEO, and president of Walker & Dunlap, Augustine Ramos, who's the COO of NMS Healthcare, John Foster Bay, who's the president and CEO of CSR Incorporated, and Francisca Alonso, who's the managing principal with AV Architects and Builders. First up is Willie Walker, who's the chairman, CEO, and president of Walker & Dunlap. What is Walker & Dunlap, Willie?
Walker & Dunlap is one of the largest commercial real estate finance companies in the United States, Peter.
Say a little bit more. Just what would that mean to the listener?
So we finance commercial properties. So
like office buildings?
Apartment buildings, office buildings, retail centers, hotels.
Mm-hmm. When was the company founded?
1937.
And how big or small is it today?
The company has 440 employees in 22 offices across the country. We're listed on the New York Stock Exchange under the ticker WD, and our market cap today is about $735 million.
Wow. And how long have you been in the role that you're in?
I have been at the company for 9 years. I have been CEO for the last 5 years, and I have been chairman and CEO for the last 2 years.
So you took over as CEO about the time the economy went south on us.
That's correct.
Say a little bit about that. What was it like?
So being in the commercial real estate lending business, when the financial crisis hit, was a very dicey time. We had set a vision to grow the company 5X in 5 years back in 2007, Peter, before the crisis. If we'd known what was about on the corner, we probably wouldn't have set our sights so high. But as banks pulled back lines of credit, as borrowers decided to get very, very conservative, it was a very tricky time. What's quite incredible is 5 years later, we've actually done it, and we've grown the company 5X in 5 years.
That's pretty impressive, particularly in the environment that you've done it in. Looking back on it, what was happening that allowed that to happen?
I think basically we saw opportunities to grow that other people were afraid to go after at the time. And so, if you will, when others were zigging, we were zagging. We were fortunate not to have a bunch of bad loans sitting on our balance sheet when the crisis hit. And so while many of our competitors were dealing with problem loans, we had a clean balance sheet and didn't have bad loans. So having that as an advantage to be able to move forward when many people were hobbled by bad loans allowed us to start growing. And we started acquiring some businesses, and then we went public in 2010 to basically create a currency to be able to grow, raise capital,
right.
And then we've continued to do acquisitions.
And even that, the IPO market hasn't been all that great either. Why go that route?
The IPO market was awful in 2009. We went public in 2010 in a somewhat better market, but being a mortgage company in 2010, we were still right in the midst of the mortgage crisis. So it wasn't as if when people read that a mortgage bank was going public, they lined up to buy into the IPO. But we had a great story. We had a fantastic company, and we had a really good track record. And so on the backs of that, we were able to go public.
So this company was actually started by your grandfather. Is that correct?
Correct.
And then so tell us a little bit about the origination of the company and how it got to here.
So the company was founded in 1937, which, if you think the last 5 years have been difficult, starting a company in 1937 was equally as difficult, if not more so, right after the Great Depression. My grandfather and my great uncle started the business. It was focused on single-family lending back then. It got into commercial real estate lending in the 1950s. My father joined the company in the early 1960s, and my father spent his whole career at the company. And we went from being a mortgage brokerage company really to being a lender in the late 1980s when we started working with Fannie Mae in a program that finances apartment buildings across the country. And then I joined the firm at the end of 2003 and have been there for the last 9 years and have had a great run.
Yeah, but you didn't start out in the family business. You took a different route to get to here. Tell us a little bit about that.
So my father went directly from the University of Virginia to Walker & Dunlop and always set a rule that neither myself nor my brother could come to the family company without doing something else for at least 5 years. So I always knew that there was no chance I was going straight from college to the family company.
Did you want to go straight from college to
the
family? No.
Never really had any interest in the mortgage business, to be perfectly honest with you. A family friend who was in the Foreign Service invited me to go to Paraguay, where he was U.S. ambassador, and I was dead set on going to Wall Street and working for a Wall Street investment bank, and my parents said, you can always go to Wall Street, you can't always go to Paraguay. And that was probably the best advice I've ever gotten in my life.
Yeah.
And so I went to Paraguay, spent 3 years in Paraguay, learned Spanish, came back to the States, went to business school, went back down to Latin America, and spent the better part of a decade down in Latin America working in finance, doing venture capital, doing private equity, and then building two businesses, one an airline and the other a call center business.
Why go back to Latin America? Why not take that business degree and apply it here?
Speaking fluent Spanish was a huge advantage, if you will. And I would also say that as I sat there and had offers from big investment banks and big consulting firms to do things in the United States, I thought Latin America got me into business school. I had to go back there and keep on working it. So I headed back down.
When you went to Paraguay, you were a kid out of college, but you didn't end up just hanging out for a few years. What did you do there?
I ended up working for a small business development foundation, something called Action International, which is actually based in Cambridge, Massachusetts, that gives small business loans to micro entrepreneurs. These are loans of $500, $1,000. And I learned the small business lending business. And so having had that experience, I came in contact with another foundation that wanted to build that program. And they had an education program and an environmental conservation program. And they asked me to come run the foundation and introduce this small business lending program. And so I ended up running that foundation and had a wonderful general management experience at 23 and 24 years old.
So after your time in Latin America, then what did you do?
I was asked by the company that I was working for running Latin America, a call center company based in Denver, Colorado called Teletech, and they asked me to go run Europe for them. And so I moved over to London, and my wife and I spent 3 years living in London while I was running Teletech's European operations. And after having spent pretty much my entire professional life far, far away from home, my wife and I had our first child. And I guess the homing beacon sort of kicked in.
Yeah.
And if I was going to leave Teletech and do something else and do it in Europe, it would be probably another 5 to 7 years living over there to actually have an impact. And so we decided to come back to the States. And I was on the board of my father's company. And I said to my father, I think I can help you. And he said, I've always known that. I just didn't think you had any interest. And so I came to Walker & Dunlop in the end of 2003.
Were you working for your father at the time?
No, I was on the board of directors of my dad's company. But I was... When I first joined the company. Oh, yeah. When I first joined the company, I was EVP and president of one of our companies and reported to my dad. And then in 2007, I became CEO.
How are you alike in this and not alike your father in the way that you run the business?
Wow, that's a good question. I think I'm like my father a lot in having a great excitement about the business and the people in the business and taking a real personal interest in the people who are inside the company. I think I am unlike my father in that my father's whole career was focused on the mortgage finance business. My father knows multiples more about the mortgage finance business than I ever will. He knows more about how to originate a loan, how to underwrite a loan, and the value of commercial real estate well beyond anything I will ever know. But because I did so much outside of this business beforehand, I look at the business in a very different way. And so the growth that we've experienced from my having been in investment banking and been in private equity and bought and sold companies allows us to look at the business in somewhat of a different manner. And so I think that breadth of experience that I have outside allowed us to start looking at new opportunities and growth opportunities rather than just doing more of what we do today.
So what do you enjoy most about your job?
Building a business.
What about it, though? What about building it? Is it just getting it bigger?
No, I mean, I walked down today to the 11th floor in our building, and we've just taken on more office space. And I sat there and said, man, you know, we keep growing. It's just fun to see the growth. Mm-hmm. To go from one office in Bethesda, Maryland, when I joined the company, to having 22 offices across the country. We had 50 employees. We're now at 440 employees. That growth is just, it's a hugely rewarding to see. Yeah. But I think the other thing about it, Peter, that is most important is that as you scale the enterprise, you create an enterprise that will keep going long in the future, is a far more stable employer than when we were a small company. You've taken a lot, you've de-risked the enterprise to make it so that people who work in the company know that you know, they don't worry about the paycheck coming. They don't worry about the company surviving.
So someone listening into this could come up with the impression that you've just had one success after the other. Talk about a tough time.
There are plenty of tough times. When I was working in the foundation, I had someone who I trusted inherently steal from the foundation. It was the first time I had somebody who I inherently trusted break that trust. When I was running the airline, we were importing the planes from the United States of America. We got them from Beechcraft in Wichita, Kansas. They'd flown all the way down from Wichita, Kansas to northern Argentina, and we arrived in the tax authority said, we're going to impound these planes until you pay both the taxes and then something on top of the taxes. There have been all those types of things. We took on debt to buy out a partner in our business back in 2006, and lo and behold, we hit the financial crisis in 2008, and I'm hoarding cash to try and make sure that I have enough to pay
right.
the debt.
Right.
So there are plenty of times in there where it's been really tough moments. There's not a person, I don't care how big the business or how small the business, how good you are, that managing the business day-to-day does not push you to your limits as it relates to the complexity and the decisions you have to make.
Yeah. What's the website address, Willie?
www.walkerdunlop.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Willie Walker, who's the chairman, CEO, and president of Walker & Dunlop. I'd like to thank Dana Theos, my co-host with Empower Consulting. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment right after this business spotlight.
This is Dana Theos with Empower Consulting, and this is your business spotlight. I'm joined today by...
My name is Lindsay Kinn.
And what company are you with?
I'm actually with an organization called Luke's Wings. It's a 501c3 nonprofit. We provide airline tickets, complimentary emergency or rotational airline tickets for injured service members and their families in out of military hospitals across the country.
And what's your role?
I am the executive director of business development. We're actually a small team of just three people, so I oversee all the fundraising.
What makes the organization most special?
Most special to me is the fact that we have such a direct impact on our military families. There's a lot of organizations that are doing wonderful work, but they're also doing a lot of different things. Luke's Wings is an organization that does one thing, which is provide airline tickets to keep our families together during very dark moments in their life. So by choosing to do one thing and doing it as to the best of our ability, we're able to have a direct impact on the most deserving families that we can think of.
And what do you personally enjoy most about your work?
It's very hard to put into words the difference I think we make, because there's nothing more important than having your family with you. It's hard to know how important that is when it's something you don't think about. But by providing these tickets, we're keeping families together. We're keeping children with their parents, and we're keeping husbands and wives together. And I love that we have the opportunity to do that.
That's wonderful. What brought you to the company?
I was a volunteer for 2 years. We got enough funding in 2011 to add someone to the staff full time. I took on that responsibility, and in the last year, we've raised about $1.3 million and been able to provide over 1,000 airline tickets.
Wonderful. How would someone contact you if they wanted to find the organization?
I would love to hear from anyone who'd like to get involved as a corporate sponsor, a volunteer, and we can be reached at www.lukeswings.org.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Peter Schwartz. I'm joined by my co-host, Dana Theos, with Empower Consulting. And for this segment, we have Augustin Ramos, who's the COO of NMS Healthcare. What is NMS Healthcare, Augustin?
We are a small chain of skilled nursing facilities in Maryland. We have a building in Hyattsville, Annapolis, and Hagerstown.
So how big is the organization in general?
We have 523 beds. We are 800 employees. Corporate offices are in Hyattsville.
And when was the company founded?
2004.
And you're the COO, the Chief Operating Officer?
Chief Operating Officer.
So for somebody that's unfamiliar with that role, what does a COO do?
We run the day-to-day operations. I have a corporate team, small one, 30 people. Basically, our job is to just make everything better every day.
With respect to running a nursing home?
Running a nursing home, we take care of all the patients coming from the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
So
do you have a medical background?
No, not at all.
How'd you get started in the company?
I met one of the owners back in 2005, and then he gave me an opportunity to start working with him in healthcare. It was my first time in healthcare.
Really?
Yes.
What were you doing?
He put me through quality assurance department, which is pretty much the center where everything goes.
Uh-huh.
And so I could learn the business. 6 months right after that, he had a need on one of the smallest business, which was the dialysis unit. So he asked me if I could just go run it.
Run the dialysis unit?
Yeah, dialysis unit.
That's putting needles in people's arms and things like that, right?
By the way, I used to hate needles. I couldn't see, something going into my body. And then, if you know dialysis, that is something that everybody's
right.
hooked up to a machine. So, but I'm a business person, so I like the challenge. And I said, okay, I'll do it. So I run for 3 years. And then we grew it from 12 chairs to 24 chairs.
Uh-huh.
It was a very, well-run business, one of the best in quality, care. We sold it another company. We own the buildings, but we sold it. So that's when I was out of a job. So I had to go to corporate to run the long-term
care. The other businesses.
Exactly.
So you told us earlier that he originally gave you that job because he didn't really have anywhere else to put you, but he saw something in you, saw some potential. What was it he saw?
I don't know. As I told you, he's a crazy guy, a visionary. I don't know anybody that knows the nursing home industry as well as he does. But probably trust. I mean, he probably thought that I was someone that that he could trust. And the offer was, as I told you, was quite funny. He said that he didn't have a job for me, but I could be running one of his his company in a few years. And he kept his end of the bargain, and I kept mine.
So what do you like most about your job today?
That it's so dynamic. It's so many things every day, and there is always room for improvement in healthcare, nursing homes, and the industry that I am. It's kind of it's been there for many, many years, and innovation is not really. It's not like hospitals, so me without any background in healthcare, of course, I was and I'm still still am very naive, so I just found
So you're learning every single day. Is that the attraction to you?
It's like probably that's one of the main ones. Being able of learning every day, and then being able of introducing ideas outside the box every single time, and having the perfect excuse for it.
Yeah,
because, But now I have a very good team. You have to surround yourself of
right.
talented people.
But you also mentioned something in the green room about the greater good, and that's important to you as well. Say something about that.
Well, you get to do what you like every day, to innovate. You have owners that allow you to, to go for it. And while you are doing that, that you're helping someone that is in need. You're in an industry that people usually don't use your services by choice. They use your services because they need it.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a very rewarding, situation.
Yeah, good. Where are you from?
Argentina. Buenos Aires, specifically.
And so when did you come to the United States?
I came in 2005.
Why?
I had a consulting firm back in Argentina. I started in the corporate world with, Burger King Corporation, then jumped into as a marketing regional coordinator, and then I jumped into Suncor, which is one of the biggest dairy corporations, for milk and yogurts, as a brand manager. It's the competition for Danone, you know, if you know about milks and yogurts. And then I guess I wanted more. I went into consulting, had my own firm. And then one of my clients, you know, with one of my clients landed here.
And why did you decide to stay?
Well, because of the offer, I guess. It was challenging, and it was something new. You know, it's I could have, if I would not have someone, you know, like Matt, you know, the owner, being where he was, you know, probably I would never got the job because I didn't have any experience in it. And every time that I got a job back, even if I go back to Burger King Corporation or Suncor, you know, back in the days, I always got a job that was not posted for me in some, you know, somehow. I remember when I went my first interview with a Burger King Corporation, he's going through the resume, and it's not like here, you know, in Argentina and back in the days, you could ask your age and, you know, all these things that you probably here can't do. And again, you know, they were looking for more mature people, but I was already there, so I just made sure that I, you know, I got that job, and it was always like that.
So what was Dad doing when you were growing up? Your dad, what was he doing when you were growing up?
Well, I started working with my father. He had a, you know, a business in the real estate industry, and I wanted to start working very soon. It was when I was in high school. I was 16, I think.
Why did you want to start working so young?
I don't. I just wanted to start working. You know, he's
was it about the money or the doing something?
It's. I think it was more into doing something. And you know, my parents, you know, my mom and my dad, they were, you know, they are still, you know, very hard workers. Uh-huh. So it's like, you know, goes in the family. So he said, okay, fine, you can just go weekends and, you know, and cover for people and sell houses. So that's what I started doing.
At 16, you were selling houses.
Yes, showing them. I would get I used to get just a very small commission, which, by the way, for someone, you know, with 16 year old, is a lot of money.
Well, looking back on it, what do you think that experience taught you?
I think working at that time so early and with my father, I think it just helped me. He taught me about, you know, work ethics, and uh-huh. you know, and he was always an entrepreneur, so I think he also taught me not to be afraid of the unknown. You know, I grew up. I was born in Buenos Aires, you know. Then we, you know, we lived a year in Paris. Then we moved to Spain in Malaga. Then we came back to Argentina. You know, my parents were always, you know, moving and exploring. So I think it's, you know, they taught me that.
What did your mom teach you?
To question everything.
To question everything?
Yes.
What did your mom? What was she doing growing up?
My mom was more into the corporate, you know, world, and then now she's, you know, she's a professor in the university in Buenos Aires, you know, in the master's. So yeah, she is. I think she taught me how to question everything. Always question it.
What were you like as a kid?
I liked sports. Played rugby, you know, for many years, and then music.
Uh huh. What about music?
Play the piano?
Uh-huh.
Play. Yeah, I know. I actually think I played better when I was 8 than what I can play now, but I still enjoy it.
Any other significant influences other than your mom and dad?
Influences, yes, of course. Well, my wife. You know, we were high school sweethearts, so we married very young. And I don't think I could have done everything of the craziness that I did and the more, you know, savvy decisions that I made afterwards, but she's been always my kind of my wire to ground, you know, my neutron.
Right.
So
people have taken a chance on you your whole life.
That's a very good point to put it.
Where do you take your chances?
Well, I think my biggest one was deciding to not to come back to Buenos Aires and stay, you know, in the U.S. I mean, this is certainly, as everybody explains about, you know, America, it is, you know, the land of opportunities if you work, you know, for it. But you know, but it's not that easy as it sounds when you have to actually go and make that decision, and, you know, and have the support from, you know, your wife and your family back at home. You know, I have 4 brothers and sisters. You know,
did you have to convince them this was a good idea?
Yeah, it was a long conversation, but she's, you know, my wife has always been supportive of all these type of decisions. So, you know, but again, it makes it easier to make the decision. It's very difficult dealing and making sure that you don't disappoint anybody.
If I was interviewing your mom and dad, what would they say about your success in America?
Oh, I'd rather don't hear that. I don't know. I don't want my parents to. I know that she, to me, they probably won't say much. You know, probably congratulations. I knew that you were right. You know, well done, buddy. You know, probably with my father is a little bit easier. But I do know what they say about me when I'm not there. So that is very comforting.
What are they saying about you when you're not there?
Oh, they brag about it all the time. Yes, of course.
What's the website address for NMS Healthcare?
That same one, nmshealthcare.com.
Great. We've been speaking with Augustin Ramos, who is the COO of NMS Healthcare. I'd like to thank my co-host, Dana Theos, with Empower Consulting. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment, right after this business spotlight. Joining us today is
Gordon Bernhardt.
Gordon, what is Bernhardt Wealth Management?
Bernhardt Wealth Management is a registered investment advisory firm. We're one of the top independent wealth management firms in the Washington, D.C. area.
What makes your company special?
I'd say three things. One is that we are a personal chief financial officer. We act in that capacity for our clients, so that means we help them address their investment issues. We also focus on the holistic approach, so that means we focus on wealth enhancement, wealth transfer, wealth protection, and charitable planning issues for our clients. Second area is that makes us special is that we are a registered investment advisor. We don't have a broker's license, and that simply means that we have a fiduciary duty to always act in our clients' best interest. Most of the industry have broker's licenses, and some of them have advisory licenses. And a broker is held to a suitability standard. We're held to the fiduciary standard.
So what that means to a customer would mean that you work in their interest, not for the interest of the stock that you're trying to sell.
That is correct. And the third area that makes us special is that we have a very academic approach to investing. Everything that we recommend to our clients is strictly based on academic research.
And what do you enjoy most about this work?
I love helping clients. You know, I'm passionate. I get satisfaction out of knowing that we touch people's lives. We can then, you know, our role is basically free up their time so they can focus on what's important to them. For some of our clients, that means their family and grandkids. For some, it's their business. And others, it's their charitable interests. We solidify their relationships in those areas.
Great. How can someone reach you?
We can be reached by phone at 703-356-4380 or on the web at bernhardtwealth.com.
Great. This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage, and we've been speaking with Gordon Bernhardt from Bernhardt Wealth Management, and this has been your Business Spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is Peter Schwartz, your host. I'm joined by my co-host, Colin Callahan with Callahan & Associates. And for this segment, we have John Foster Bay, who is President and CEO of CSR Incorporated. What is CSR Incorporated, John?
CSR Incorporated is a consulting firm primarily working with government clients. We do management and logistical support. We do information and communication, and we do research.
What kind of research?
We do research, social science research. We do a lot of things in performance measurement. We work with the Department of Justice. We also do a lot of secondary data analysis for the National Institute of Health.
When you say social science research, what does that mean?
What we focus ourselves on particular issues that have some social import. So, uh-huh. For example, we're doing a lot of work with programs in both juvenile justice and in the Bureau of Justice Assistance that are aimed at reducing crime or dealing with juvenile delinquency. With the National Institute of Health, we're looking at particular health issues. For the last 20 years, we've really been doing a lot of work with alcoholism and issues of alcohol abuse.
Wow. And how old is the company?
Well, the company was founded in 1978.
So it's been around for a while.
It's been around for a while.
How big or small are you today?
We are roughly between 60 and 70 people. We've got revenues in the neighborhood of about $9 million.
And when did you join the company?
I joined the company in 2008. I joined as the director of research and evaluation. My background is in research and evaluation and mm-hmm. Social science research.
Yeah. And when did you become president and CEO?
I became president and CEO in December. I believe December 11th of 2011.
So just a little more than a year.
So how's
it been going?
It's been very exciting. While the company has been around since 1978, we actually feel like we're moving into a startup phase. I succeeded the founder of the company, and as she left, she's still part of our board, but she's basically said, CSR is now yours, and you can do with it as you see fit. And we've tried to pull together a good executive team and really start to think about the future.
So where do you want to be in 5 years?
I'd like to be a company that is at least several, you know, we're $8-9 million. I'd like to be up around $14 million. I think if we get that kind of growth, then we start to really have fun. I'd like to be actually in a position where I can identify my successor and be able to get the next generation being able to take over.
So you say that your background's in social sciences. Take us back to the beginning. What was going on that got you interested in social sciences?
Well, I'll tell you, I have actually got interested in social science because I kind of see myself, I don't see myself as a scholar, but I do see myself as a change agent. And that really comes a lot from my dad. My dad had a somewhat unusual background, but he was a musician, he was a painter, ended up spending his working career working for the Transit Authority of New York, but he was also spent a lot of time educating me about social issues and encouraged us to think beyond ourselves and our own issues.
So is that kind of like the topic of the dinner conversation? Or?
That was the topic of the dinner conversation. And we had lots of very lively debates around kind of the right way to do things. What do we have to do in our communities to make them better?
So about how old were you when these conversations first started happening?
Gosh,
that you recall?
I can remember those kind of conversations happening before I was able to take part in them, probably when I was 7-8 years old at least.
So looking back on it, what do you think a 7 or 8 year old, how are you impressed at that young age by the stories that make you want to actually do something about it?
Yeah, I mean, I was impressed by the passion that I saw around.
In your father?
In my father and in the people that were dialogued about this with. Yeah, that's what impressed me.
So you were doing some other crazy things as a six-year-old too. So why don't you tell us about one of them?
Yeah, well, we didn't have a lot of money when we were growing up. We grew up in the South Bronx in the projects, and my dad managed to give us the princely fee of 25 cents a week as an allowance, and my brother and I tried to figure out, well, how can we make the 25 cents grow in some sense? So we identified a number of different schemes, and we used to run errands for people. But we realized that no one delivered newspapers, the Sunday newspaper, in the projects. Everybody on Sunday, it doesn't matter whether you were rich or poor, you don't want to go out on Sunday and look for a newspaper. You want to sit, stay with the family. You want to, watch some TV, listen to the radio. But no one ever delivered a paper there. So we figured out that, well, what if we took our 25 cents and we were, between my brother and I, we could make a 50 cents. What if we went out and bought newspapers and then sold them for maybe a nickel more than the cost to us? And let's see if people would buy them. So we started to do that.
At 6 years old.
At 6-7 years old, we started to do that. And people bought the papers. And we had a routine that we would keep buying papers until we couldn't sell any more. But by that time, at the end of the day, we usually would amass at least $5 or $6 that was pure profit. And we were very happy with that because that was enough to go to the candy store and buy comic books, go to a movie. So.
So you were an entrepreneur at the age of 6.
I guess. I didn't think of it that way. I just thought it was a way to get some money in my pocket.
What was your mom doing at the time?
My mom was a stay-at-home mom. She's the one that really kept the family together. She was the fun one. She was the one that we all talked to about everything. As I got older, she was the one I talked to about girls. I mean, as odd as that would seem, but she's the one who taught us how to dance. And when we started getting into athletics, she was the one who she would go into out in the street with us and race us up and down the street. And she was actually a very good athlete herself. So she was the one who kind of made us believe that if we wanted to do something, we could do it if we were willing to work hard enough at it.
And who were some of your other early influences?
There were lots of people who, in one way or another, kind of came into my life. But one of the people who, by the time I got to high school, who really was a major influence for me was my high school basketball coach. He's recently passed, but he was the one who looked at this kid who was, you know, in the 10th grade, who had really never seriously played basketball, if you can believe that somebody who was over 6 feet had never played, but I managed to do that, who had a little bit of athletic capabilities, but certainly no one could confuse for a real basketball player. I was not, no one thought of me as the next Michael Jordan or Jerry West or anyone like that. But he just saw somebody who was willing. I had a great attitude, as he said. I was willing to do anything it took to learn and succeed. And, you know, he spent the time with me, and it paid off. By the time I graduated from high school, I went from sitting on the very end of the bench to actually being on the New York City All-Star team.
Wow. So how and what did these influences with your dad sitting around the table, et cetera, and your basketball coach, how do you bring that forward into today?
Well, one thing, my dad taught me that there's something beyond myself, and that's always been important. I mean, I've had ups and I've had downs, but the idea that there's more out there than just what was just me was important. It helped me keep going. My coach taught me that you really had to look beyond what was on the surface. I mean, if you just looked at what I was like when he first saw me, there's no way that anybody would have spent time with me. He was able to look beyond that, and it's something that has been important to me. It's taught me to look beyond that in myself, but also as a manager, as a leader now, to try to see that in other people as well.
So you went to college?
I went to college. I went to undergraduate at a little place called the University of Bridgeport in Bridgeport, Connecticut. In fact, I spent a lot of time in college, surprisingly. I got a master's in public administration from the University of Hartford, MBA from Yale.
And so what were you doing? An MBA from Yale?
Yeah, and I have my doctorate from Georgetown.
So that's quite a lot. What did you do to prepare yourself professionally for the role you're in today, particularly around the social sciences? Just give a little bit of a thread there.
You know, that's in some ways that's a hard question. I did not. If someone were to ask me, okay, you're going to be here, what are all the things you planned on doing to get here? I would say I didn't plan on any of this. I think one of the things that I'm open about is there are lots of things I can't do, but there are a few things I won't try. And so I was willing to try something new, and I'm always been a big fan. My mother communicated to me the importance of education, and so I've always been open to learning new things. So
you spent some time in the federal government, though.
I did spend some time in the federal government. I was at the some place called the Corporation for National and Community Service, which actually runs the AmeriCorps program and runs the Senior Corps and a few other things of that nature. I originally went there to be a part of the AmeriCorps program, but also ended up working in what was called the Research and Policy Office.
Would your father be surprised at your success if I was interviewing him right now?
You know, no, I don't think so.
What do you think he'd say about you?
He would say, wow, that's a good question. I think he would say that this is somebody who I knew would succeed because he has his head on straight. And he works hard, and he cares about people and things around him.
Great. John, what's the website address?
www.csrincorporated.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with John Foster Bay, who's the president and CEO of CSR Incorporated. I'd like to thank Colin Callahan with Callahan Associates as being my co-host here. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment right after this Business Spotlight. This is your Business Spotlight, brought to you by Peter Schwartz, a Vistage chair with Vistage International. And joining us today is
Pat Chance.
Pat, who are you with?
I
am with CompuData, where I am the Director of Business Development in the D.C. metropolitan area.
And what is CompuData?
CompuData is a technology company delivering end-to-end solutions. And by that, we deliver business management software, which really includes Sage and Epicor ERP. Along with that, we also provide hardware, technical support and planning, hosting, disaster recovery, and professional services to meet the needs of our customers.
Wow. What makes your business special?
What makes our company so special? We've been in business now for 41 years. Our president and CEO is Angela Nadeau, and she was honored most recently in Forbes magazine as the 100 most powerful women in business. Along with that, we've won many business awards, such as Accounting Technology, VAR 100, and the Business Journal.
Ooh. And what do you enjoy most about your job?
I enjoy helping companies and, most importantly, people, helping them find the right solution to run their businesses effectively.
And why do you think your customers appreciate you?
They appreciate us because we are the trusted advisor. They depend on CompuData to deliver the right solution to help run their businesses.
How can someone reach you?
At www.compudata.com, and please visit me on LinkedIn.
That's great. We've been speaking with Pat, who's with CompuData. This is Peter Schwartz, and this has been your spotlight for the day. Have a great day. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is Peter Schwartz, your host. I'm joined by my co-host, Colin Callahan, with Callahan & Associates. And for this segment, we have Francesca Alonso, who's the managing principal of a company called AV Architects and Builders. What is AV Architects and Builders, Francesca?
AV Architects and Builders is a full-service residential design-build company. We specialize in major renovations, additions, and custom homes in the Northern Virginia area.
And when was the company founded?
In 2001.
So that's a little unusual, isn't it, for architects and to be builders at the same company?
It is very unusual, and that's a good thing for us. Because,
why did you decide to do it that way?
Because we felt like we weren't helping our clients until the end of the process by just delivering design plans and not assisting or being, you know, part of the process during construction.
So you thought that the best way you could help the customer was to build the thing you designed as well?
Correct.
And so you started in 2001. Is your entire background in residential architecture?
No, I actually worked for commercial architects before that. Right after I got out of school in 1992, I worked for Dubery and Davis, a company in Fairfax,
sure.
A very large company. And then I worked for a small architecture firm in D.C. So my background really is in architecture, design, and helping families.
Great.
So what caused you to start the, what was going on to start the company in 2001?
I really wanted to get my foot back into architecture, and I had a six-month-old, a one-year-old, a three-year-old, and a five-year-old, so I thought that going downtown working for a big company was not going to quite work out. So I started figuring out how can I be in architecture, how can I design stuff and still be at home. So I thought the best thing was to just launch my own company so that I could create my own hours. And I could just work around everyone's needs, kids, husband, and business, just all at the same time.
And that worked out for you?
It has worked out great. It's been 12 years, and I wouldn't change it for anything.
So four kids under five, and you're studying design business. Did everybody support you in that?
No, actually, the only one that supported me was my husband. Everyone else thought that I was totally crazy, that it was just not a good time, and that I should wait five more years because that way all the kids would be in school and I would have all this spare time. But I figured if I wait five more years, I'm just going to be totally bored, and I'm just going to be at home, and I didn't just want to be at home. And also, I had clients before I even had a business. There was a need out there for homeowners to have someone help them with their residential design projects. And I wanted to be that person.
So then 2008 happened, and we had this thing called a housing recession. How did that impact you?
Well, actually, 2008, and 9 and 10 pretty much has been for us sort of a rebranding opportunity. Since we didn't spend much time in figuring out a business plan, a marketing plan, a branding plan, all those things that you typically do before you launch a business, we just kind of just launched the business and worked. When 2008 came around, I thought, well, I have less work, so this is my chance to actually give the business thought and figure out how to take it to the next level since I have a little bit more time now. And that's what we've been doing for the last 3 years, and now we're going in a much bigger direction.
So how are you different then?
Different from other people, you mean?
No, different, now that you've had this time to step back and think a little bit more about what you want to be as a company, what's different?
Well, I think that I have much bigger goals now. I feel like I really want to impact many more people than we have. In the past, we've been working with one-on-one, one client at a time. And now, and first with just design, then we got into the build. And now we're launching AV Builders. We're actually developing spec homes. And that's just a whole different world. And I wouldn't be able to do that because if I wouldn't have had this extra time to actually give this some thought.
So where did this interest in architecture come from?
Well, I think that growing up in a household with my dad as an architect, who from day one never told me ever that he was having a bad day. I just watched him every day enjoying himself and occasionally saying to me, and I'm having such a great time, and those fools pay me. And so, this just kind of, I wanted to have that too.
So you always wanted to be an architect?
I always wanted to be as happy as my dad was with my work. And it just so happens that I'm good at architecture.
And so when you went to college, did you know you were going to be an architect?
No, I'm a little bit of a contradictory person. When my dad thought that I was going to go into architecture and everybody else thought I was going to go into architecture, I told him, Dad, I'm going to do something. All I know for sure is that I'm not going to be an architect because I really need a break from architecture. But funny enough, as things are, I took this elective and the teacher told me, you really should go into architecture. And I just looked at her and I said, do you know my dad? And she didn't. So next thing I know, I was faxing my dad the admittance letter from CUA that I got into architecture school.
This class that you took, what were some of the pivotal points there that
it was,
brought you?
It was a huge turning point for me because it was a class called Thinking with the Right Side of the Brain. And it just talks about how people that do that, and you can really apply this to any industry, but the fact that you look at an issue and you can resolve it in a three-dimensional format, and it doesn't have to be a building, it can be any problem that you encounter. Can you look at it from different angles? And I have an ability to do that. And my dad gave me this book when I was 9. And when I saw the book in the class, I thought, oh, this is going to be an easy A, because I know this book inside out. But I didn't know it was going to change my career path.
You mentioned also that your dad talked architecture all the time in the green room. You told us this. And there was something that you said there about him talking about architect and people. Can you say more about that as an influence on you?
Yes. Everything we did, everywhere we went, everyone we were with, always had the spin from my dad's words, somehow always came back to architecture. But it wasn't in architecture as in the philosophical way of talking about it, historical way. It was more about how it's for people. He always used to say that to us, like, this building is for people. It's not to show off anything. It's not to make a statement. People have to use it. And if it's not friendly to them, you failed.
And how does that influence your work today?
I think that that's the primary reason why I focus on residential design build, because I love working with people, especially families with kids. I love making their space better.
So what's changed in the way that spaces are designed nowadays than when you got started?
I think that there's a huge trend to design homes that are more friendly to casual living. 15 years ago, there was a lot of big homes, small homes, with half of these rooms that weren't even utilized. And we call them museum rooms. And it's just kind of sad to have all these rooms that you pay for, but you really never spend time in. And homes today are turning into design a house that actually will use all the spaces.
Where are you from, Francisca?
I was born in Chile, Santiago, and I grew up in Spain, in Marbella, in the south coast of Spain, because that's where my dad wanted to do his architecture.
In Spain?
Yes. And then I came to the United States in 86 to go to architecture school.
What do you remember most about growing up in Chile?
It was a very happy time, and we had a lot of friends, and both of my parents worked in a big retail business. Mm-hmm. They were very entrepreneurial, and I remember that all their friends were big entrepreneurs.
In Spain, what was that experience like for you?
In Spain, I think that it was a lot of adjusting. My mom had to leave everything that in her eyes was perfect to trade it for where nothing was perfect. So I think I learned early on that when things get comfortable, it's time to change something so that you can actually get better at what you're here for. My dad did that 4 or 5 times, and I didn't realize that until 3 or 4 years ago when he was sick and I was spending a lot of time with him. It just kind of, the light bulb went in my head about that.
Uh-huh. What were you like as a kid?
Probably very difficult, but because I like to always look at things from a different angle. And when someone tells me, when too many people tell you it's a good idea, usually it's time to look at other options. And I have 4 kids, and 2 of them are like that, and they are very difficult. They give me a lot of challenges, but they're probably just like me. And the other 2 are more compliant, and so it's a journey, definitely.
Your father with us still?
No, he unfortunately passed away two years ago.
I'm sorry. Was he aware of your career trajectory and proud of you that you went into architecture?
Very much so, very much. He wasn't happy that I stayed here because he wanted me to go back and work with him. My 2 brothers and my sister run the company now in Spain that builds resorts, but he was very happy that I was I'm very passionate about architecture and people, and that's exactly what he was like.
If he was here right now, what would you like to say to him?
I would like to thank him for being such an amazing role model and showing us how important it is to have integrity and to follow your dreams and to just do whatever it takes to do the right thing for people.
Wonderful, wonderful. What's the website address, Francisca?
It's www.avarchitectsbuild.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Francisca Alonso, who's the managing principal of AV Architects and Builders. I'd like to thank my co-host, Colin Callahan, with Callahan and Associates for helping me out with the interviews. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We have great guests on our show today, including Willie Walker, who's the chairman, CEO, and president of Walker & Dunlap, Augustin Ramos, who's the COO of NMS Healthcare, John Foster Bay, the president, CEO of CSR Incorporated, and finally, Francisca Alonso, the managing principal of AV Architects and Builders. I'd like to thank you, our listening audience, for without you, we wouldn't have a radio show. This is Peter Schwartz, your host. Have a great week. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to Executive Leaders Radio, the region's premier radio show highlighting local executive leaders. We hope you've enjoyed the show here on 1500 AM. You can learn more about Executive Leaders Radio by visiting executiveleadersradio.com or tune in next time right here on 1500 AM. That's Executive Leaders Radio.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, and your source for federal news.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News